Welcome to another Tech Doctor podcast. This is a podcast with a bit of an international flavor. I'm so happy to have with me tonight a man that I've known for quite a while. His name is Scott Erickson, all the way from Australia. How you doing, Scott?
Yeah, good, good. I'm in Sydney, actually, so it's really nice weather here, and we're in autumn now, so it's not too bad.
Yeah, we're in spring and you're in autumn. How about that? Well, tell us a little bit about yourself, if you will.
Okay, well, I'm actually a musician. The technology is just a love of, really. I was, you know, born in Sydney. I actually went to a blind school for about 6 or 7 years, and that was where my kind of love of music and technology started. We actually had a piano teacher who was blind, and she taught a lot of us. I think there would have been majority of the school that could, if we didn't play piano, played something. And I kind of kept it going, and I integrated into the local school because it was nice to be with my two brothers, who at one stage all three of us were at the same school, so that was quite good. And then I went to high school, and my older brother, I think, tipped off the music teacher that I was, well, in his words, quite a good musician. So they kind of snapped me up to do everything. So I used to play for the shows, you know, different musicals we did. And I remember, I think I was in about year 9, and I played for, I think it was 17 HSCs, which is basically the end of year, the end of sort of your schooling certificate here. And I'll never forget, I turned up to English class one day to tell the English teacher I wasn't coming. And she says to me, "Oh, you're not coming today. Well, do me a favor. Don't turn up until you are coming back to class." So that was that was quite good. So moving on from there, I went to university at the Sydney Conservatorium, which is a very, I guess, prestigious music school in Sydney. It's not a college as such. It's basically attached to another university, and you just attend during the day. You know, it's not a live-in college or anything like that. So I studied jazz music, and I graduated with first-class honours from there. It was a lot of work, but it was one of the more fun 4 years. And then after that, I had an interest. I'd always been interested in technology, mainly blindness technology, but any form of technology. And I obviously, you know, you'd be the same. We have to use computers and technology of different forms to, well, communicate, particularly for us. You know, we have to use it to communicate, and we have to use it to, you know, make use of everything to do with daily life. So I insisted on, you know, I really wanted to know how the stuff worked, as opposed to not just sort of, okay, this technology works, but let's see how it does what it does. So I really, looked at that, and I was always interested in how things did what they did. So I dabbled in a bit of like computer hardware building. I've built several desktop PCs and things over the years. And I've, you know, also, I love my Braille. So obviously I used Braille extensively. Not as much in school, because I did use it. The teachers weren't interested in the Braille as such, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean in terms of a speed thing. So what they wanted was you to instantly produce material and them to be able to read it. They couldn't be bothered waiting and waiting for you to write, you know, for your aid to, you know, write over the Braille, or for you to, you know, produce it into print. They wanted it in print instantly at the same time as the other kids.
Yeah, I sort of had the same situation where I would actually use a typewriter to type the information for the teachers, but of course I couldn't read it. I could only touch type it.
Yeah, well, there is that too. Well, I was lucky enough, because I finished school in 2002, so I'm Technology was starting to be introduced in terms of, you know, laptops and
things like that.
But I mean in terms of the fact that it was actually compatible with what the other kids were using. So I had a laptop. I had, you know, this little actually battery operated printer, which you could carry around in your bag.
Oh yeah, I had one of those. That's pretty cool, and you could just print it out then.
Yeah, and that worked. Except obviously, the only thing you couldn't do was music, and that frustrated me. So I was determined to work out a way of producing music from Braille into print. Never really found a way that I liked. I've tried all the solutions. Dancing Dots have got a solution for JAWS and various other things. There's another project out there called Music Access, and that's Sibelius scripts for a really popular notation program called Sibelius. So I did some things using those solutions, but the problem was, in the end, it's like when you scan material, you are always going to get errors, and that's not your fault. That's just the nature of the technology. Well, with music, it was more in terms of formatting. Like, I'd write parts, and the music would be, people could read it, but it would be, there'd be little things wrong. Like, for example, the text that you wrote in would be too close to the music, or the notes would be too closely spaced and things like that. So in the end, I used to dictate the music to friends and we'd fix it up.
When you actually started your music training, did you at that point use Braille music, or did you memorize everything, or how'd you go about getting to the point where you were able to write music?
I didn't start learning Braille music until I was about 10. I've got perfect pitch, and a lot of blind people have got it. I do know a few as well who don't. Mm-hmm. It's you either have it or you don't. I attended a camp here, which is called the National Braille Music Camp. It's a camp for people that are totally blind from about the ages of, I guess, 10 up to 80. So anyone can go. It's held in Mittagong, which is about 2 hours away from Sydney. This camp, I attended it for, I think I went to 16 camps in a row. I didn't miss one. So I went from when I was 10 in 94 until 2009.
That's a long time.
Yeah. After that, I haven't been back, partly because, you know, I've had various things that clash, but also in 2010, I went to New York for a month and a half, but I'll get to that later. Obviously, you can't read and play at the same time, so you have to memorize it. You know, I could always memorize things, but what I focused on throughout, like, my schooling, and particularly in uni, was speed of working things out by ear. Like, I could always work them out well because I have perfect pitch, but I wanted to be able to work it out, not instantly, but really pretty much close to instant, so I could listen to anything and just go, okay, that's that. No one can get it instantly, but it's about speed and accuracy, I think. It's like when you listen to music, I'd much rather hear something that's lyrical and nice than hear something that's got thousands of notes in it that's a bit messy.
Is it true that, do you think, that it's very hard to maintain the quality or the clean sound, the integrity of the music, the faster it is? I mean, it's harder to play cleanly really fast.
Yeah, it is. And it's very interesting, actually. I when I started playing piano, I was obviously taught by somebody who was blind. So my piano technique, if you're not familiar with the way you're meant to play piano, you're supposed to play with your fingers curved. Mm-hmm. I played for about 15 years with dead straight hands. I had a bit of a scare at first year at university. I got RSI for about 6 months, and
I honestly
thought I'd never play again. But I found a really good teacher who wasn't actually part of the Sydney Conservatorium where I was. She was separate, and I worked with her for about a year. And every so often, every couple of years, I go back to her for a lesson or two just to you know, just to make sure I'm still on the right track, really.
Uh-huh.
And my technique obviously isn't perfect, but it's a lot better than it has been. You know, I'm able to play now without, you know, obviously without any pain and things like that. I think also typing helped, you know, computer typing, well, touch typing, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
That really helps because obviously you have to type with correct fingering. In my family, myself and my mum are the two fastest typists. She used to be a secretary. And so whenever anyone wants their assignments typed, they get me or they get her to type it because, you know, we can type not only with speed but with accuracy. It's that same thing that I was saying, you know, with music. It you can do things as fast as you want, but if the accuracy isn't there, you may as well not bother.
So you think that muscle memory in some ways, there's a little bit of transfer between the computer keyboard and the piano?
In a way, I think. Obviously, not completely, but there is some element of similarity there.
You decided to obviously pursue music as a career, and clearly you've been studying it since, you know, practically your whole life. I'm assuming that you really have a great passion for it. You really love it.
Oh yeah, yeah. In 2005, and this was about halfway through my university degree, my parents took me to New York for my 21st. So I got to see some of the great jazz musicians. So I got to see Chick Corea. I saw Kenny Garrett. That was the best $10 gig I ever saw. And the Chick Corea gig was about 140. So there's a big difference.
Yeah, you're right.
But, you know, I had some lessons over there. I had a lesson with a guy called Dave Kikoski, and that's spelt K-I-K-O-S-K-I, and he's worth checking out just because it's really interesting music that he writes. And my honors thesis was actually on his particular music. So I actually got some of the his sheet music from him, and much to the horror of my university friends, because the music was so difficult, we played it, we had a lot of fun. We still play it. I still play it, some of it at gigs. I always pick the really hard ones to play it because for a bit of fun. But I think, you know, learning from him was amazing. You know, just to see how he wrote, you know, how he wrote music. Some of the great players aren't necessarily great teachers, but at $100 an hour, I only had 1 hour with him, but it was the most productive, most, you know, amazing hour I'd ever had with a teacher, because he could not only play, you know, amazing music and write stuff, he was also more than willing to, like, share his knowledge.
That's great.
I think that's the case with a lot of them.
It's interesting that you choose the hard ones. You sounds like you like the challenge, but how does it work out?
Oh, it works out all right because, in a way, because, I mean, obviously I play, you know, the easier stuff as well. But the reason I choose the harder ones is, I guess, it's not hard always necessarily in terms of playing. It's more, I find in his case, a lot of the harder ones that he's written are actually the more beautiful tunes. Which I think really says something about the way he writes. He's written some beautiful simple tunes as well. But I'll send you a few recommendations of some songs just to give you an idea.
Cool. I'll look forward to that. Are you currently making your living playing music, or how does that work at this point?
I'm getting whatever gigs I can. I'm still, you know, having the odd jam with friends, and I keep in contact with a lot of my musician friends. Wherever I get the opportunity, I go and watch gigs. I still practice every day because, you know, I want to keep that, you know, I want to keep that up. I try and do sort of 3 hours of practice somehow a day.
Wow.
It's kind of hard to fit in occasionally, but, yeah, you know, that's kind of life, really. I guess for a living, when I finished uni, I sort of thought, okay, realistically, music is going to make me some money, but unless I teach, and it's not that I didn't want to teach, I just, there's a whole lot of things involved with teaching music, and I just thought, no, I want to look at something else. And I thought, in the end, I want to be able to make, you know, money to pay, you know, the bills and everything. So I thought, why not? I've got an interest in IT, so why not sort of look at that? And at some stage in 2007, I got contact. I was at the time testing the software JSafe for TNT consultancy, and I got contacted around halfway through the year by the managing director, and he said, "Oh, we're looking at setting up an office in Australia, and we want to, you know, we want you to do all the technical support stuff and the training and things like that, but we need a you know, a manager, somebody who's going to run it." And I, you know, I got super excited, so, you know, ran out and called up my parents and told them. And my dad said, "Well, I've worked in the IT industry for 13 years, so why not? You know, I'm happy to do it." And, you know, so I contacted them. They came out here and met us, and they said, "Well, there's two options here. Either we're going to meet up and start up a company, or we're going to come out to Australia and have a 5-day holiday on the beach." So they, the first option happened, of course. We started the company in March of 2008. That's when we launched TNT Consultancy Australia. And we did that for, I guess, until about January or so of, well, maybe June even, of 2009. And in the end, as can happen with some of these businesses, Australia is a lot smaller, obviously, than the US or the UK. So the demand was there, but it wasn't enough to kind of, you know, keep everything going.
Oh, that's too bad.
So, yeah, but, you know, I still value everything I got out of it. I mean, my dad obviously taught me a lot about how to, you know, work in a business, how to, you know, all about office, like, work and things like that. So I did learn a lot. I met, you know, some great people. I got to visit, you know, a few interesting places. I went to New Zealand for a full 25 hours.
That's a little more than a whole day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I went from the airport to the hotel, to the Foundation for the Blind, to the hotel, to the airport, and home. Wow. So it was, you know, it was interesting. I've kept in contact with a few people that I've trained over the time and stuff. And then in 2010, I kind of, well, I wanted a bit of a break, so I focused on music for about, 6 months or so. And in that time, I went over to New York for 5.5 weeks in August of 2010, and basically just had a whole bunch of lessons with various musicians, went to all the jam sessions every night, and just sort of led the party life. Well, in general, I mean, it was, I still got a lot out of it. I saw some amazing performances. There was one band that was so good, I saw them 8 times.
Wow.
But every performance was completely different material, so it wasn't like I was wasting my money, you know. I mean, I would have seen them anyway, but just in terms of what they played, everything was completely different.
Did you happen to see my very favorite New York band, the Lascivious Biddies?
I didn't, actually. I did see they were on, but they weren't on until I was leaving.
Too bad.
Yeah, I'm going over again. This will be the first time publicly I've actually said that why I'm going over, but I'll tell you that at the very end. But I got contacted while I was over there by the CEO of Quantum Technology, who have been around for about 25 years. In Australia, and they are responsible for things like the Mountbatten. They're the master distributor of the Freedom Scientific products here. They're also distributors for Optilec, who, you know, do braille displays and magnifiers and things. And they contacted me and said, "Oh, we might possibly have some work for you." And I thought, "Oh, okay, this could be pretty amazing." So, you know, I went and met up with them, and we had a chat, and, you know, did the whole interview and all that. And I started working with them about 2 weeks after I got back, which was enough time for me to get over the jet lag.
Yeah.
So I worked there for, I guess, about 15 months. And unfortunately, at the end, in January of this year, they were struggling a bit, as all the businesses do financially at the moment. Well, a lot are. And about five of us were made redundant, and I was one of those. But,
oh, too bad.
It was a shame, but I still, you know, I couldn't afford to sit there and feel sorry for myself that I didn't have a job, because otherwise, you know, you end up with that whole mentality of, oh, well, you know, life's not worth living and all this
right.
stuff. So I just straight away the next day started looking on, different websites and things, trying to find, you know, different work. I looked in mainstream IT and other places. Then I was talking to the director of Pacific Vision. Now, Pacific Vision here are the importers of the HIMSS products, which is like, obviously, well, you're a big fan of the HIMSS products, I know.
I am, indeed.
I have been for a while. So, you know, the BookSense on hand, the magnifiers. I'm not sure what a following the magnifiers have, but I know, obviously, everyone knows about the BookSense and the BrailleSense.
Right.
So they sell, Pacific Vision distribute that. They also distribute the low vision side of Freedom. So the magnifiers, you know, things like the Pearl and OpenBook and the Cerasy and stuff. I was talking to him and he said, oh, look, if you're looking for some work, we need, you know, I'm happy to for you to do a bit of work for us. And I thought, well, at the moment, I'll take anything I can. I mean, the opportunity was great. So I did that, and for the last 2 weeks, I've actually been traveling around country New South Wales. So I've been in a different hotel every night. Me and another guy have been doing the traveling. There's me. I'm doing sort of all the blindness braille material, and he's doing the low vision things. So we kind of work as a team together. And there's another blind girl in Queensland, and she's Chantelle, and she looks after the braille up there as well. And I guess, it's been great. The interest has been really interesting because we've had HIMSS stuff here for about 12 months, I guess.
Oh,
so
I didn't
it
realize
hasn't been out here very long.
I didn't realize it was that recent, so it really hasn't been very long.
No, we could get them, but you had to go to desperate lengths to get them from and find a dealer in the US or somebody in the US who was willing to buy the product for you if you paid them and ship it out here.
Oh,
and
I see.
So I did manage to get a BookSense a couple of years ago and things like that. But I guess having, you know, the distribution here is great, obviously, but it's nice having access to things, having, I guess, direct access to the manufacturers in a way, because, you know, quite a few of the companies are very approachable. HIMSS are very good in terms of, although the Korean language barrier can be a bit interesting when you see the English responses, but, you get used to that.
It is an interesting issue to try to clearly communicate with one another, especially on technical matters where you need fairly precise communication. But it works out.
Yeah, it does. And I think this ties nicely into where you were saying to me that you've known me for a while. We've been involved in various testing things over the years.
Yes, we have.
But, for different companies. I've done testing for a lot of companies. I've done some testing for HumanWare over the years. I've tested things for Freedom Scientific. I've tested things for Sendero. And for Nuance, who obviously did talks. That's still around, but I think Everyone's pretty much, you know, iPhone these days.
A lot of us have moved on, yes.
Yeah. Oh, I've still got an E75 sitting here.
Yeah, I've still got an N82 here.
Oh, okay. And the KNFB reader. Pacific Vision actually sell that still. They still sell KNFB reader. They, you know, people look at it. Although the main interest lately has certainly been the Braille sense and the and of course, you know, all the excitements around the U2 when that eventually is released.
Yes, it was really funny. My son, who's a freshman in college this year, his iPhone broke at one point, and so I loaned him the Nokia N82, and he was using that as a substitute until his contract could be renewed so he could get another iPhone. And so we went to visit some family over the holidays, and he had this N82 on his belt, and my brother-in-law comes up to him and goes, "Oh, you've got such a retro phone."
Yeah, and, exactly.
And I think, I think my son was a little frustrated, like, "Well, my iPhone's broken right now, you know." But it was kind of funny, and it is.
Because everyone just expects you these days to have, well, I guess not necessarily an iPhone, but a touchscreen phone of some sort.
Yeah, you know? But it is funny because those phones are not, relatively speaking, really all that old, but the technology has just changed really fast.
I think it does, and I think that's we notice it here. The only thing that we're jealous about in Australia is that you guys get all these cool devices in the States before we do. But we beat you with the iPad. We got the iPad before the US did.
Oh, really?
The iPad 3. The new iPad. We can't call it the iPad 3.
Right. iPad. The current edition iPad. So yeah, you actually got it before we did, huh?
Yeah.
That may be a first.
Yeah, I think it is. Because normally, you know, we have to wait for the second or third launch in some cases. You know, because they roll it out in stages to certain countries. Apple products for me have really, really made a huge advancement to ease of use. I mean, I guess for work purposes and things like that, I still use Windows. But for all my personal things, the Mac and the iPhone and everything, they work really well.
Yeah, I think you and I have both been using the Mac for a while, and certainly the iOS devices ever since they've been available with VoiceOver on them. And I love the Apple products myself, and I'm for the most part okay with the way that Apple, you know, controls them, and because it's one of the reasons, honestly, that accessibility works so well in their products is because they have control of both the hardware and the software.
Yeah, well, that's right. And I think also that I actually had access to a beta version of, Tiger before it was released, about a year or so before it was released.
Oh, wow.
And, that was a bit, it was hard work, but it did work. And because back then, obviously, you didn't have Alex. That came in Leopard, I think.
Yeah, I remember that Tiger speech. I wasn't using it, but I have gone back and done some listening to some of the different examples of it. Even one that Steve Jobs presented at a keynote. I guess it was a WDC conference, Developers Conference, and he showed some different examples of the speech comparing Tiger with Alex. I started out with Apple products, with the Apple II. It was my very first computer.
And it was the one I learned to type on.
So it was sad to me when I had to leave the Apple II world and join the Windows world, or actually join the DOS world at that point.
Yeah, DOS, yeah. DeckTalk Express.
yeah, DeckTalks and DoubleTalks and all those fun synthesizers and screen readers that we had back then, you know, but but we almost all of us ended up leaving Apple when the Mac came along because there just wasn't very good access.
It didn't exist. I don't think it even existed at all.
Well, yeah, there was one company.
There was Outspoken.
Yeah, right. Berkeley Systems made Outspoken, but it wasn't. It never really widely caught on. There were a few people who used it, but unfortunately, the access didn't come back to the Apple platform until they moved to Intel and Tiger came along, and voiceover was developed and all that. And so, of course, it's great to be back in that arena. But I'm kind of curious, you know, speaking more globally than just one company or one technology, what is technology like for people who are blind in Australia? I mean, what is there a lot available? Can people get equipment that they need, or how does it work over there?
Okay, if you work, like as in if you've got a job, you can get funding to basically get the equipment for free, provided, well, free as in your employer pays it and you get paid back. For things like note takers, laptops, braille displays, and things like that. But you have to obviously go through an application process and say, you know, this is why I need this technology. They don't always approve it, although I do know one guy who puts in huge amounts of technology every year. Actually, there's two. They're both brothers. They put in huge amounts every year and get everything that they want. So the money is there, but I know a guy who put in $16,000 worth of technology and got it all, but and that was one application.
And this is government funding.
Yeah, it's government funding. It's called Job Access, and you have to be working a certain amount of hours a week to be able to apply for it. And if the stuff is under $10,000, then they generally will approve it. If it's over $10,000, they actually come and visit you at your work to see that your job requires what you've requested.
So if it's approved, then I was a little unclear that they pay for it and
yeah. So basically, you or your employer pays for it and they pay you back.
I see.
So you get reimbursed for the technology.
I see.
It used to be specifically note takers and braille displays. Now they're doing a lot more. So they're not just doing note takers. They're doing note takers and laptops. And I know somebody who got a Mac. They will do whatever you require to get your job, to do your job.
So it sounds like maybe at these days it's a bit more open in terms of they're not just stuck on certain companies or certain technologies, but they're willing to provide people with maybe things that aren't quite as well known or maybe a little more on the cutting edge, like the Macs or something.
Yeah, well, that's true. They are stuck on certain companies just because the certain companies are the only ones who do that product, like if it's blindness products. But, and this is the thing, some people are like, oh, this product's, terrible. This product's much better. Don't get that one. It's like competition is healthy. I think, the fact that we have so many different note takers. I see all these debates all the time on Twitter and various things about note takers and, you should get this note taker. Don't get that one because it's terrible. None of them are terrible. They've all got their strengths and weaknesses. Some have more strengths than others and others have more weaknesses than strengths. But, they've all got a purpose and I'm lucky I've had all of them.
Yeah. We don't do a very good job of really matching the proper technology with the specific person.
Yeah, no, there's that problem here as well, and it's a big problem more so in education. I think this is a really important thing because you get a lot of people that, they try and match the person to the technology rather than the technology to the person. You've got to match the technology to the user, even if it means you have to see them three or four times with three or four or even more bits of equipment to say, okay, use this and like.
Well, it means that the person doing the matching has to take the time to really learn the technology and also to really learn the person that they're trying to match it with, and that just doesn't happen well enough or often enough, at least not here.
No, it doesn't here. And the thing is, obviously here we're more limited in terms of, because I mean the products are much more expensive over here. In some cases, almost two or three times the amount that you buy for in the US. But that's how it's, you know, brought in and everything else. But I think, you know, one thing that's really interesting, and I've thought about this often, I've thought sometimes the assessors should be blind people. Like the people that actually demonstrate the equipment, they should actually have blind people demonstrating the equipment if the person, you know, is blind. Because, I mean, we know our braille, you know, we know, like, if yes. it's braille technology, we know how to use it. The sighted people, and I'm not, you know, discrediting sighted people at all. There are some sighted people I know who are really good at braille and really good at their technology. But I think, you know, the assessors are just going on pitches. They're just the people that hand out the money don't understand the technology. They're just people right. that sign the bit of paper that say, yeah, you can have $10,000 or whatever.
Right, exactly.
I think, yeah, it's important.
Yeah, we really need to find a way to improve that process. And I think that in some ways, the bad economy and the what Apple has shown that mainstream technology really can be made to work well for people, I think that puts pressure on everybody to do a better job of fitting people with appropriate technology at a reasonable cost.
Yeah, I think so. And I think as well, you know, I mean, I'm all for mainstream technology and things like that. But I do think also that we still have a place in the market for note takers. I don't know, maybe I'm old school, but you know,
well, you're such an old guy. That's the thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
I know. But yeah. You know, I agree with you though, Scott. And there are people who wouldn't agree with me. But I'm an example. You know, I work for a university, and I use a lot of mainstream technology, all the Apple products and peripherals and all that. But when I go into a meeting, which I do fairly frequently in my job, I like to take a Braille note-taking device. And of course, you know, those note-taking devices could be a Braille display with an iPhone essentially as the brains of the whole operation. And that works fine. And Apple's done a tremendous job of giving us reasonable Braille capabilities with the iOS devices, but it's not as smooth and as expedient in a lot of cases as a note-taking device, like one of the HIMS products or one of the HumanWare products or something like that.
And yeah, exactly.
And with the HIMS products, you actually can have the best of both worlds. You can have your note-taking device standalone, or you can just tap a couple keystrokes and have it turn into a terminal that's connected to your iOS device. And you can actually essentially use both at the same time just by switching back and forth with just a few keystrokes.
I think that's really important because you can't do that as far as I know, and I did do some testing with this, but I don't think you can actually do that with the Apex. I'm happy to be corrected, but I don't think you can switch between apps on the Apex while it's still connected to the iPhone. I know with
I don't think
HIMS,
you can.
You can.
Yes, yeah. With HIMS you can because of their ability to multitask while the terminal mode is still running,
that's really unique and really clever. Actually, I think
It's a feature that people don't even realize just how important it is, but it's going to become even more important with some of their new product.
Exactly. And I think one thing I've noticed with HIMS, just from monitoring the user lists and stuff, I mean, obviously over here those lists are specifically for US people, but you do still get some great information out of it. And I've noticed they're really responsive in terms of fixing bugs and putting in features that we're going to use. Like, Who would have thought that putting a Twitter client into a note taker would be, I didn't think anyone would ever do it. And then HIMS brought out version 6 and it had a Twitter client.
Yeah. And they really want to make their products, I believe, as state of the art, as usable for what people are currently doing on the internet and everywhere as they can. So they really are paying attention. And, you know, I find that Twitter client, being able to access your timeline in Braille sometimes is extremely handy.
Oh, it is. Particularly, I find, if you want to look something up, you don't necessarily want to, because, you know, I'm like you, I don't tend to post to Twitter like a lot. I go through stages, but, you know, to be able to, particularly to be able to retweet things and to look up articles, you know, you'd be like, oh, I'm sure I saw that on Twitter the other day, so I'm just going to look in here. And then you can read the article in Braille, you know. And I think, you know, another thing to come out of all of this is the fact that these note takers, they keep your Braille skills up. I know a lot of people, and there's this statistic that keeps floating around that says less than 10% of blind people in the US can read Braille. I don't know, you know, sort of, I mean, it's been floating around for ages, so I don't know if it's true or not. But, you know, so I see so many, you know, I'm on a couple of the sort of buying and selling lists, and I see all these people, you know, selling, like, all these, you know, really cheap note takers. And I'm sort of thinking, well, keep it for your Braille skills, like, to keep your Braille skills. I think, you know, I mean, speech is great, but there are times where Braille really, really helps you. And yeah, I think a lot of people forget that. A lot of people are like, oh, we can get by with just speech. You can. And I think, yeah, that's important. But I think, you know, having the Braille there, there's just something amazing about Braille. It's really hard to describe. It's just something amazing about having Braille at your fingertips.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. We've been talking a lot about Braille on this podcast because for me personally, I am just so enjoying Braille these days. I read the New York Times in Braille because of its easy availability on these note-taking devices. It's easy to download and easy to read. And one thing I've come to really value is that I just seem to get so much more out of it when I slow down and actually read an article and see the spelling, see the punctuation, see how it's laid out. And yes, it takes a little longer. You know, there was a time in my life where I wanted everything to be sped up to 12 times its normal speed and, you know, get through as many things as I possibly could, as quickly as I possibly could. And that worked for me. You know, it still works for me. I can speed listen really fast. But there is a real place for slowing down and digesting something. And when I have something I really want to study, especially some technical materials or materials that I'm really interested in knowing a lot of detail about, there is no substitute in my workflow for Braille. It's really the only written language that we have that we can read with any reasonable amount of accuracy and speed and all that.
Exactly. I went through a period, I think I'm still going through that period, where I can read Braille music faster than text, but I think that's just me.
Yeah. But you've probably done it a lot.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Well, I went through a period where I didn't want to touch Braille, and it wasn't that I hated it, it was just that, you know, everyone was going sort of, I never said that it was dead, but my Braille skills weren't as good, and it was sort of like, I got to the end of my schooling, and I'm like, okay, for university, I'm going to get some sort of Braille note-taking device. And I got a Braille note at that stage. I had a choice of going to America with the school band or getting a Braille note. I chose the second option.
Yeah. Isn't it sad, though, how it comes down to that so often? I don't know how many times on my job I've chosen to get a piece of technology rather than attend a conference or something like that. And it's just very sad that we have to make those kinds of choices, those kinds of sacrifices, just to be able to read.
Oh, that's true. But also, I think there's a sense of excitement about getting, you know, a new piece of technology.
Oh, of course.
And, you know, we'll never lose that. I mean, no matter how old you are, you still, you know, you get the box and you're like, oh, okay.
Oh, you're like me, boy.
Can I leave early today?
Yeah, I love getting those boxes. I can definitely agree with you on that.
I got the Jam Box recently, and that's just a fantastic little speaker.
It is, isn't it?
For my 2 weeks trip, you know, I took it away. I thought, I need some good music. So I took it with me. And, well, firstly, I went to the Apple store because it's actually a bit dangerous because I live across the road from an Apple store.
Oh, you lucky man.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that. My credit card wouldn't say that.
Right.
But
I'm sure Apple's okay with it.
Yeah, they're happy. They're very happy. But I think what's really great is that, you know, I went in there and I said, okay, I want to look at the Jam Box. Well, at first no one had a clue what I was talking about. And then this lady came out and said, oh, yeah, the Jam Box. So she went over, she found me one. She said, oh, would you like to look at one? I said, yeah, well, that'd be great before I shell out all the money. And I said, you know, if you haven't got one open here, don't worry. Well, a lot of people say how good the experience is in the Apple store. This wasn't the first time I'd been in an Apple store, but it was the first time that I'd had, like, real one-to-one service, you know. So this lady came back, she said, we don't have any open, but I'm just going to open one. So she opened one, and it honestly took her a while to open. I don't know if you...
Yeah, they're not that easy to open.
But yeah. So she showed me how it all worked, and that was great. And, you know, I just loved the fact that it talked, and that was that made it... Well, not that it was necessarily... you didn't need it to talk, but that's just an extra lovely bonus. You know,
oh,
you
it's a nice
the battery status. And, and then she says to me at the end, okay, so you want to get one? And I was like, yeah, okay, I'll buy one. She said, would you like this one that I've opened, or do you want, do you want your own, you know, to, you know, in a box? And I didn't even think about it. Oh, yeah, better take a new one, you know, not thinking that.
Well, yeah, you don't want to take that.
It's going to be the open.
You want to take that one some guy's been messing with already.
Nah, well, no, she was the only one who'd been
using it. Oh, I know, I'm just teasing
you. Oh, exactly. So I got home and I literally, honestly, sat on my couch for about the next half an hour thinking, how on earth do you open this box?
Oh, yeah, I know. I just went through the same thing.
Yeah, and, you know, you're still excited about, you know, the whole aspect of getting a new piece of technology. Like, I remember when I got my my own hand, you know, I hadn't had a note taker for a while, and I'm sort of like, oh, box is so small. And then I, you know, I opened it and there were 1500 things in the box. I'm like, oh, this is very exciting, more packaging, you know. And yeah, I really like the on hand you know, for size, particularly for size, I think, you know, for travel it's amazing.
Yeah, we're talking about the HIMS Braille Sense on hand, which is an 18 cell display in a very small package. It's a very nice note-taking device, and as I said earlier, a great terminal for iOS devices, and it really is an exciting product. If you haven't seen it, you should go and check it out. It's a nice device.
Yeah, I think you know, like, I'm, as I said earlier, I'm heading off to New York in August, and my reason for going is I get a lot of, you know, musical newsletters, like, you know, from the great artists and a lot of people, different music shops and things like that, because, you know, they're free, obviously, so you get them. I get the Chick Corea newsletter, so, you know, you find out when he releases his CDs, when he's on tour. I've seen him a few times when he's been out here. He's a, for those who don't know, he's a piano player who's a jazz piano player who's been around for about 40 years.
Oh, yes.
And he's really developed with the times. You know, every time you hear music from him, it's completely different. Like, I just got an album which I'd recommend to anyone who wants to kind of experience classical and jazz, because he's written a concerto for jazz quintet and chamber orchestra.
Cool.
Apparently it took 8 years, and it is available on Amazon. So for anyone who wants to get it, have a look on Amazon. You will find it. I can't remember the name of it, but it's a double CD.
Is it on iTunes also, I bet?
It should be. That I don't know. I'm assuming it is. A lot of his stuff is. But what's interesting is that it's two CDs. The first CD is the concerto. The second CD is just some pieces that he wrote for the quintet. Oh, and some standards as well. And it's basically just the quintet playing without the orchestra, which is nice. A bit of a nice touch.
Yeah.
But in this email as well, saying that, you know, that had been released, so I went and bought that because it was only $15, you know. And, you know, the CDs have come down, but I couldn't find it anywhere else. So in the end, I thought, okay, I'll get the CD. It went straight into iTunes, but...
Yeah, of course.
So in that email was also a thing that I saw which said 5-day masterclass that Jit Kcareer was doing in the US in Lenox. And I thought, okay, I bet this is for some special university thing and I probably can't go. So I didn't even like bother to look. I just flicked the email to my parents going, hey, I'm going, you know, I'm going to this. And then they wrote back and I got a one-line response that just said, very expensive. Okay, where are the prices? So I looked it up. It's $49.50. It's $4,950, not $49.50, which would be nice. But that includes the hotel, the meals, all the performances, and everything. Doesn't include your airfare, but that's fair, I think. So I thought, okay, rather than just sort of, you know, racing to sign up, I'll ring them up. So I rang up the place that are putting it on, and I said, okay, I'm from Australia, and what's the deal with international people? They said, oh, as long as you can get here, you can come. I'm like, okay. And how many spaces left? She's like, oh, three. I'm like, don't make me pay now, you know. So I basically, you had two ways of paying, which was a bit interesting. You could pay in full, or you could pay in two amounts. You could pay half now, and then by May you had to pay the second half. But you had to tell them to charge your credit card. And I'm sort of like, no, let's just pay in full now. So I've actually got my spot. So I'm going over there in August to participate in the class, which I think it's going to be an amazing experience. Just to, I mean, apart from the fact that he's had 40 years of music making, he has just done a lot with really interesting music, and he's played with some, you know, amazing people and things like that. But it's a trio. It's not just him. It's actually him, John Patitucci, who's a bass player, and Antonio Sanchez, who's a wonderful drummer. And no one else knows, apart from, well, people on this podcast and a couple of my close friends, that I'm actually going. So this is kind of the first... public announcement, I guess you could say.
How exciting. Sounds like it'll be a great time and a great learning experience.
Yeah.
What did you say the class was? You said something about Lenox.
No, it's in Lenox. It's in Massachusetts.
In Lenox, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Okay. I thought, wait a minute. We're mixing music and a very strange operating system together here. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, don't worry. I've played with Linux, the operating system. It's command line heaven, really.
Yeah, it is.
But it actually on my Mac I've got Linux, Windows, and OS X. And for those who are just interested in a bit of geek talk, OS X is based on Unix, which was around before Linux anyway.
Right.
So
exactly. Well, that's exciting for the summer. So, wow, that's something to look forward to. I can't wait to hear how you like it and what you learn and how it goes and everything.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to hopefully, I mean, I don't know what in terms of restrictions I've got in terms of recording, but I won't record the classes, but I'll record a couple of maybe audio booths and sort of say that I'm there and, you know, and things like that. I've been getting into it recently. I haven't posted anything, but I have signed up to it, and I've just got to, link it to Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah, I like Audioboo. It's fun. It's a neat service. I wish you could record a little longer on the service that they provide for free, but that's how it works.
Yeah, did you manage to get the 3-minute service or the 5-minute service? Because they've decreased it now. You only get 3 minutes
on the free version. I suspect I signed up early enough to get the 5-minute service.
Yeah. 5 minutes is okay, but you can get 30 if you're willing to pay.
Yeah, it was quite expensive, though.
That's why I haven't paid either.
Right. Well, Scott, this has been really fun just to chat a bit about music and technology. We haven't done too much on the Tech Doctor podcast with music, and so it's fun to branch out in that a little bit. And even though we're about to come to the end of the talking here, I want to invite everyone not to immediately shut off your podcatcher as soon as we sign off here, because Scott has told me he's going to send me a piece of music that I can share with you all that he's playing at the end of the podcast. So be sure and stay around for that. So that'll be cool. I'm looking forward to sharing that with everyone. Thanks for agreeing to do that.
Oh, no worries. I've just for some kind of finishing up info, I've done 2 albums. I left all that out, but I figured, you know, that's all right. I've done 2 albums. I did an album in 2005 before I finished the conservatorium, and that was with myself, a drummer from Japan, who happened to be studying over here at the time. He's now back in Japan playing, you know, great. Craig Scott, who's a bass player, he's also the head of the Sydney Conservatorium jazz course, and Dale Barlow, who some may have heard of. He played, he basically spent 10 years in New York. He played with, you know, Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers and Cedar Walton Quartet and a few other famous international bands. And they agreed to do the album. They all were very kind enough to do it for absolutely nothing. And it was amazing. I wrote some tunes for it. Dale wrote some tunes for it. And the drummer also wrote a tune for it. And then my second album I recorded in 2010, but due to all sorts of things, I didn't release it until last year. And that one was actually with a whole bunch of my friends that I went through university with. I had a young bass player called Alex Bonham, who's a fantastic bass player. He just, anything you want, he'll do it. And he also played for my recitals and stuff at the conservatorium. He was younger than me, but he had serious ability. The drummer on the album is James Jennings. He's another guy from around here. He's done quite a lot of stuff. None of these guys are international, but they've done some good things locally. And a wonderful sax player who I went through, who was actually in my year at the conservatorium. I've done a lot with this guy. His name's Jeremy Rose. He's done very well for himself. He's got his own record label called Earshift Records, and you know he's got a band called The Vampires and another band. I'm trying to remember all the names. He's in so many different projects, but when you hear him, you'll see why. He's a brilliant musician. These guys again, you know, they're great friends, and they again did it for nothing. Which was amazing. We had the launch of the second album last year at the conservatorium. I actually launched it at the university in the cafe.
Is there a way for the Tech Doctor listeners to get a hold of these albums if they want to?
Yeah. They can contact me. That's probably the best way. At the moment, I've only got CDs of the albums. Well, of the second one. The first one, I need to get some more done. I am going to put them up on... I'm going to eventually get them up on iTunes, but the reason they're not up there is because of artwork. Like, I've got artwork for the CD, but because, you know, it was launched independently, if you know what I mean. It didn't have, you know, I didn't have, like, a full-on case with cover art and everything.
Right.
So, I mean, it still had artwork on the CDs, but yeah, it was okay. It was a bit, it was cheaper to do that because obviously I was funding it all myself.
Sure.
Yeah, and the recordings and everything, I funded everything myself. So it was just like, look, you know, I'm going to do it the best, but, cost-saving way. Obviously I wasn't going to, you know, pay less if it was going to sound worse.
Right.
And, yeah, so, you know, they can contact me. I'm on Facebook. You can go to facebook.com/S Erickson. So that's S-E-R-I-C-H-S-E-N. And then you can add me. I do have two Facebook accounts, but that's the one to add me where I that's more for, you know, things where you'll find out about gigs, things like that. I've got Twitter. That's twitter.com/S Erickson. So S-E-R-I-C-H-S-E-N. And I've also got my my website, which currently doesn't work. So I won't give that out, only okay. because I'm redesigning it. And actually, there's nothing there at the moment. But okay. I will obviously let people know when it's up. And I plan on putting a little, you know, a buy option in there for people to buy the albums directly.
Excellent.
But otherwise, there's the old-fashioned email. And I say old-fashioned because apparently these days, according to an article I read the other day, they say that texting is more popular than email now.
Yeah.
So, you know, people would much rather text you than email you. So I'm not going to give out my number.
Probably not a good idea.
No. I'll get 300 texts in the next hour. But, yeah, you can email me, and my email address is very appropriate. It's pianoman, so P-I-A-N-O-M-A-N, at scotterickson.com. So that's scotterickson.com. Now, some people will be thinking, oh, you're in Australia, there's no AU, but no, there isn't. Believe it or not, the domains in the US are actually cheaper than the ones over here.
And oh, wow.
Over here, you actually can only sign them up for 2 years at a time, and they're about $50 for 2 years.
Mm.
That doesn't include hosting or anything. I've signed mine up until 2015.
Excellent.
So, and then I'll just keep renewing it. Apparently, the service I'm with, you can pay $100 and register it for 10 years at a time. So, which is really good.
Well, great. And I hope you'll be hearing from some people as a result of this. And thanks for taking the time to spend some time telling us about what's going on with you these days. I appreciate you coming on the Tech Doctor podcast.
Yeah, no worries.
If anybody wants to get in touch with me, of course, as always, you can email the Tech Doctor at techdoctor123@gmail.com. And I will invite you all to sit back and relax and listen to the music. So long for now from the Tech Doctor. Thank you.